Listen to it. It sounds so pretty. Remember the Wimbledon ball? They played my song. Unforgettable. So pretty.
The idea of this podcast came to me while I was watching a brilliant BBC documentary on the wonderful Arthur Ashe. Now, focus of the program was, of course, Ashe's brilliant strategic victory over Jimmy Connors in 1975. During the course of the narrative, up flashed on the screen an image of Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King dancing together at the 1975 Wimbledon Ball, the moment where the two winners of the world's most prestigious tournament come together in dance.
Well, I mean, obviously, we've got someone here who knows a lot more about it than we do, don't you, Teddy?
Oh, yes, I do. Thank you, Buzz. The Wimbledon Ball has a long and beautiful history, and I'm so pleased to be part not only of this podcast, but part of the history itself.
We associate tennis players as being great athletes, Teddy.
Yes.
But an athlete doesn't necessarily make for a good dancer. Now, Teddy, when you're fitting out a player for a new set of shorts or a skirt, and once you have a firm grip on their leg, can you make a call on their sense of rhythm in that moment?
It's incumbent upon me to understand the character, the personality of the person I'm dressing. I always say to the people I'm dressing that I'm not making them beautiful. I'm making them more beautifully them.
That just must take their breath away when they're hearing words like that coming from the mouth of somebody like you, Teddy.
Well, it's a bit of a sales pitch on my part, I must say. But no, I get the measure not only of their inner thigh, I get the measure of the man or woman as well. Mm. And I could tell, measuring up Arthur Ashe, that he would try, but I don't think he was a great dancer. Billie Jean had more something about her that I thought, yes, she could probably move. Of course, I could be wrong, and I have been wrong before, but generally speaking, I think I'm about 90% correct in all of these.
I get the sense, though, with Billie Jean that she was a very enthusiastic, exuberant type person, but I'm not sure how that would have translated into rhythm and dance, but I could be wrong too. I haven't witnessed her dancing. You have?
There was nothing subtle about it. There was nothing subtle, but what she lost in subtlety, she absolutely gained in enthusiasm, as you said. So she could beguile you into thinking that she was dancing the most recent, the most beautiful thing, where if you looked at it objectively, you would turn away in disgust.
Well, I guess you had to be there, Teddy, but thank you. And we're going to be bringing you in through the course of this podcast, Teddy, really to give us an inside view, because as we're about to discover, information regarding the Wimbledon Ball is a little hard to find.
It's a nice tradition that's been a little bit of forgotten. 86 was the last time the champions danced with each other, so before that it was a very respected and nurtured tradition. And so we thought we can actually give a little rebirth to the dance, suggested that to Serena, she accepted it. I thought it's going to be a bit of a classical tune, but she chose 80s, Night Fever. I accepted that challenge. You can imagine how it went. It was great. I was a very lucky guy because she's a very, very good dancer.
Now, Buzz, I had a couple of heated discussions with you recently. Not that I was heated with you, but I was getting quite angry at a lot of the doors that were being slammed shut in my face whenever I tried to make any inquiries to the All England Club about the origins of the Wimbledon Ball. And there is an absolute paucity of information out there. I have no idea what's going on, but very difficult to actually trace when the ball started and where it was first held.
It's like pulling teeth, isn't it, trying to get that sort of information. Not only is there just nothing on the internet in terms of any video, there's hardly any record of it. And it's quite a strange thing when you think it happened every year for so long. Mm. And there would have been news reports. It would have been included in news reports. I'm just wondering if maybe, Teddy, do you know any reason for this?
Well, no, Buzz. I do know for a little while there that Wimbledon burnt in a bonfire any reference to the ball. I don't know why. It was something that happened yearly, happened after Wimbledon. And, all records simply went up, including photographs, including any signing book they did for the ball. Yes, all gone.
I'm not surprised to hear that, and that explains a lot. Of course, we're still left with the question of what they're burning.
Could I just cut in here, Remo? Maybe our listeners don't actually understand what the ball is, what the dance is we're talking about. So the night of the men's, is it that night?
Yeah, it's the Sunday on the close of the championships, the Sunday night.
So that night there's a ball, and traditionally the men's winner and the women's winner would get together and dance.
That's right.
So that's what we're talking about right here, and the fact that there's no information about it, even though for years and years and years this went on every year. You think there'd be photos. I mean, it'd be a great photo opportunity, and there's hardly any. Well, how many photos have you seen?
Well, that's my next point. The earliest verification of the Wimbledon ball comes in the form of a photo that I stumbled across. It's 1953 is the year, and it's a photo of Maureen Connelling sitting at a table of honour, dressed in a beautiful ball gown, laughing whilst a man is stooping and whispering into her ear. Now, this is the earliest photo I've been able to find. This is only 1953. And just harking back to the photo, the man whispering into Maureen Connolly's ear is the spitting image of the 1954 Wimbledon men's winner, Yaroslav Drobny. Teddy, my question to you is, what on earth is Drobny doing at the Wimbledon ball a full 12 months before he should be there?
Well, the question, I don't know, did Drobny win the doubles?
I checked that, and no, he didn't.
There goes that up in the air, doesn't it? No, well, Drobny was everywhere in 1953 and 1954. You hardly saw a photo of him not being there, wherever he was meant to be. I remember seeing photos of the Academy Award winners for that year. There's Yaroslav Drobny on the edge there. What did he win? Best Supporting Actor? I doubt it.
We have the ubiquitous Mr. Drobny here, just essentially making his presence felt wherever he could.
I think it's worth noting to people that Wimbledon started in 1877.
Mm.
I don't think there would have been a ball straight away, but certainly by 53, that's a lot of Wimbledon balls they would have had by then.
Oh, look, perhaps the ball started in the 1920s when Wimbledon moved from Warple Street to Church Road to accommodate the public demand to see such superstars as Big Bill Tilden and Susan Longlon. I can picture, Teddy, Tilden and Longlon doing a tango or a Charleston, and this could have been the start of the Wimbledon ball. Does that sound plausible to you?
It sounds plausible. I would love to see Suzanne Longlon doing the Charleston. You know how I feel about her. Of course, she passed away before I was even born.
Mm.
But her legend lives on, and I would love to see that. And Big Bill Tilden, well, the less said there, the better, I feel, generally, about Big Bill.
Although, what a couple of egos. Ted.
Absolutely, they would have filled the ball.
Well, no tennis court or dance floor, imagine, could contain those two egos for very long.
No, exactly, exactly.
How does Angie celebrate tonight?
Well, I would like to propose a dance with the song Lady in Red. I think it's appropriate.
But how are you going to celebrate when you go back to Germany?
You know, first of all, I say yes. I mean, I will dance with you. I mean...
Have we got any music? Do we have music? I don't know if we have music.
Yeah.
Now, we heard earlier on in the podcast that Novak Djokovic made reference to the fact that he and Serena Williams basically brought back the tradition of dancing at the Wimbledon ball, something that hadn't happened since 1986, Buzz.
So this is in 2015.
This is in 2015. So we are talking a period there of a good 29 years where there has been no dancing between the men's winner and the women's winner at the Wimbledon ball. And the clue there, obviously, is 1986 was the last time it happened. And
who won that year?
That was Becker? Boris Becker and Martina Navratilova were the two winners. So they were the last couple.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I wonder if, Teddy, do you know, did something happen that evening in 1986 when Boris and Martina did that dance? Is there something that happened that maybe put a kibosh in the whole thing for that period of time? When he danced with Martina, and I've heard this from some people, he had little control of his knees. So it was a very strange thing. She was a little shorter than him, obviously.
Mm.
His knees were banging into her hip bones and at one point almost dislocated her pelvis.
I think that's what happened. And she looked up at him and with a scowl on her face. Now, you must remember about Martine, who's on court. She was very serious. Off court, a lovely lady. Mm. I hope you know her. One of the great ones, you know. And it was a little awkward. And I think the members of the All England Tennis and Croquet Club looked at that and said, well, I don't think there's a future for this anymore.
Enough's enough, old
Enough's
chaps.
Enough, yes, absolutely.
Tell me how much you remember.
It's 1968 at the Wimbledon Ball. And the singles winners always used to start the Wimbledon Ball with dancing together.
You felt like losing the match out there because you knew you'd have to dance that night.
You're not kidding. Oh, my God. That's the biggest dread of the whole tournament.
Teddy, now, let's play a little game here, just to end off the podcast.
Certainly.
I'm going to throw out a few famous couplings, and I want you to illuminate the scene for us. 1960, Neil Fraser and Maria Bueno. Now, Neil Fraser, as a staunch Baptist, Teddy, as you know, was forbidden to dance. So, Teddy, what happened when the band cranked up a version of The Twist and the spotlight fell on Fraser and Bueno?
Well, Fraser, as they used to call him in Australia, stood up, ram rock solid, and it was a strange moment because everyone was watching him, wondering what he would do. I had obviously designed Maria's dress again, Maria Bueno's dress again, and I went for something a little different, and I'm glad I did because it gave her room to bend her knees. Right. And so she was twisting around Neil Fraser as if he was some kind of maypole, and he stood there with a look on his face as if, well, like a statue from Easter Island, so stern. And there's Maria Bueno, knees almost touching the ground, twisting around Fraser and having the time of her young life. And she looked up at me with a glint in her eye, and she sort of waggled her eyebrows ever at Fraser, just to say, get a look at this stiff. And the members of the All England Club started to clap with her. In the end, it kind of worked.
It worked
in a strange, obtuse way. It worked.
Wonderful, wonderful. Moving on. 1964,
ah, yes.
Roy Emerson and Maria Bueno. Now, Teddy, Maria claimed, and you'll know this, never to be quite the same player after dancing that night with Roy Emerson, the exuberant Roy Emerson. Those there recount a story involving Emo incorporating the actions of milking a cow during the Canadian three-step to a raucous version of Ragdoll by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Teddy, can you describe how it ended in injury to both these wonderful champions?
Well, it was a scandal, really. That's the only word. I don't know what was going through the head of the leader of the band or certainly the leader of the All England Tennis Club, Tennis and Croquet Club, I should say, to give it its full title. There's Emo kneeling on the ground making these milking gestures. Now, some people in the crowd thought he was making them towards Bueno. And I thought that was the most disgraceful thing I'd ever seen. Maria, on her part, she was a little older now. She wasn't a 17-year-old innocent that she was in 1959. She was still in her early 20s, but she'd travelled the world.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I designed her dress and I was there. And I was there with her that night. She asked me along to partner her. Mm. And that was such a great, what would you call it?
Well, an honour for you.
Honour is the word, exactly. Escape me, I'm getting a bit old.
No, and she obviously was developing into a very sophisticated young woman. Again, I can only imagine just to be met by this display by Emo, God bless him, must have shocked Maria.
Well, I think particularly in comparison to what had happened 4 years earlier with Fraser, I think she thought Australians were ramrod straight and very sullen. And suddenly here's this guy on the ground trying to milk something imaginary. It's very hard to milk something imaginary. Mm. But Emma knew how to milk a cow. Don't be, in any doubt of that.
No doubt. But obviously at some point things got physical between the two of them in some sense where they both ended up being ambulanced out of the ball.
Maria went over and she was actually trying to encourage him to actually dance with her and not work against her as he was doing. And so he got her to stand up, but he was still milking it to some degree. And she was trying to do the three-step with him, and then his elbows got a bit out of line, and she had her, I remember once she tried to move past him, and he misinterpreted, and his elbow came back on the back of the nape of her neck, and bueno went down and onto the floor. And of course, everyone thought it was part of the dance, and they applauded, but bueno was almost out cold. I ran to her, and I held her. She thought she was dying. I said, Maria, speak to me. And she said something in Portuguese that to this day I don't understand, but the gist of it was pretty much, please let my parents know that I love them.
And then Emma interjecting with anyone for milk at that point.
Emma was uncontrollable. I think he'd had a few. I hope he'd had a few, because that's how he acted normally. Then But look, I got to know Roy years later, many years later, actually. It's sort of interesting. I got to know many of the Australians at the time, but Roy was one of those gentlemen I just couldn't quite take to first up. But he was a good man. Mm. You know, he still is a good man, and he held the Grand Slam record for many, many years. Totally undeserved, but he held it. And, you know, I mean, I think he knew, and we all knew that Rod was the superior player. But God love him. Mm. He was a damn fine tennis player, and I won't hear a word against him.
Buzz, I know you've been listening with a smile on your face.
Absolutely.
To some of Teddy's anecdotes there. They're just priceless.
I love having Teddy in the studio with us. It's just
Doesn't it make a difference?
It's amazing. Yeah,
it's wonderful. Let's finish, Buzz, and Teddy, of course, feel free to chime in here. With the year of 2017, Roger Federer and Garbiñ Muguruza. The point of note here is after the women's final had been won by Garbiñ, she was asked about the upcoming men's final between Roger Federer and Marin Cilic. And she was asked who she would like to dance with. Without even a moment's pause, she answered, Roger. I would like Roger Federer to win so I could dance with Roger and see if he's as elegant on the dance floor as he is on the tennis court. My question is this to both you gentlemen, feel free to answer whoever would like to answer this, but has any other Wimbledon finalist ever gone into a match carrying that sort of baggage, hurt, that sort of pre-match rejection?
That Marin Cilic took into that match.
Well, we know Cilic is a very sensitive soul.
He is, he is.
And those comments would have got back to him.
I don't think it was saying to Cilic, you're not someone I want to dance with. I think she was saying to Federer, I just want to dance with you.
You don't think on the change of ends, Federer waltzing onto the court to receive serve was a dig at Cilic in any way?
I looked at that and I thought, does Roger really need to do that to beat Cilic?
It was rubbing it in.
And Cilic crying in a changeover. Did you mention that? Cilic crying in a changeover.
Well, he broke down numerous times through the match. Yeah. And I know for a fact that Cilic and Muguruza ran into each other waiting for their sandwiches in the Wimbledon cafeteria. There must have been a moment of awkwardness there. I'm sorry. I know what you're saying, that it could have been anyone, not just Cilic. But it was Cilic.
It had to have an effect. I can't think of another Wimbledon where anything like that has been said before the match.
No.
But then I haven't seen as many as you, Teddy. Is there anything that you perhaps remember from a past Wimbledon that might even approximate that?
Mm.
The one that I remember was in 1977 when Virginia Wade won the centenary Wimbledon women's singles crown. What an occasion that was. And who won the men? None other than the great Bjorn Borg, who we've talked about before. Now, after Virginia won, obviously the British press went absolutely crazy for her, and they asked her many questions, and they said, who would you like to see win this, Bjorn or Jimmy Connors? And Virginia came out with the classic statement, I could never dance with a man with a bowl haircut.
Well, perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Absolutely reasonable, I thought at the time. But Jimmy took it hard. Jimmy was angry that day. And he went out and he took it to five sets. Of course, Bjorn beat him, Bjorn being Bjorn. But Jimmy had a bee in his bonnet. I remember in a changeover in the fifth set, I heard him muttering to himself. I was behind the umpire's chair in the first row there. And heard him muttering to himself. And he said, I'm going to dance tonight until the cows come home. I don't know if it was an Emerson reference, but that was it.
Teddy, thank you.
Insights that we never would have got ourselves at Remo, isn't that right?
Totally, totally, Buzz. And I defy our listeners out there to find any information on the Wimbledon ball, and please send it in to us, because that's what we've been able to piece together.
From the scant information we've been able to find.
That's right. And if there's any more out there, we would love to hear from you.
If there were any photos, wouldn't that be wonderful? Although we are a podcast, it'd be pretty hard to publish them.
Well, here. We could describe them.
We could describe the photos.
We could describe them. I mean, we've referenced two, Maureen Connolly and Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King.
Yeah.
So, yeah, send your photos in, any recollections, any chance sightings. You may just, if you were in London at the time, wandering past wherever it is they hold the ball. Teddy, where is the ball held? Is it a different venue every year? Like, does it move around? Is it at some underground gentleman's club? Accessed via a seedy laneway in a London suburb?
Well, in the 60s, it was hurled in a ballroom in the centre of London. I don't remember its name precisely. I do know many things happened there over the years. Beside the Wimbledon Ball, it wasn't, of course, just for the Wimbledon Ball. Many balls were held there, but many parties as well that I attended. And sometimes it was funny to be at a party and then you'd think of what happened at the Wimbledon Ball just a month ago.
Well, I think on that last thought, we'll leave you, and thank you again for joining us. Can't wait to catch up with our next topic.
Yeah, thanks, Teddy. That's fantastic.
Thank you, Teddy.
No problem, boys. Good evening.
Buzz, why have you brought me, and don't get me wrong, I'm really appreciative that you've actually brought me into the men's locker room here at Wimbledon, but why are we here, man?
Let's know about Djokovic. Have a look at his coach. He's talking to his coach.
He's talking to his coach, and why is his coach naked?
Yeah, and Djokovic is wearing a suit.
Is this what they do before every match? Like,
no, it's very, very hot. Anyway, look, the reason I brought you here is that I want our listeners to subscribe to the podcast.
Mm. So you've brought us to the men's locker room of Wimbledon to deliver that message, have you?
Well, I thought it was appropriate. I don't know much about subscription.
Shh, mate.